Good evening and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here on Countercurrents. Tonight I have a guest by the name of Ryan Falk. Ryan is an interesting fellow whom I discovered online some time ago. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, your ideas, your influences, that sort of thing.
Okay, well, my background is not something that I like to put out on the internet very much, so
okay,
I'll just leave that at that. But really, I think what you're asking me about is some of my views on the interwebs, and that's actually kind of a long trajectory. If you want to start from the very beginning, I started off as a theocrat. I would read the Book of Revelations, and I was a big fan of Revelations. In fact, when I was in church, I was actually a bit concerned as to how uninterested people were in the Book of Revelations. And so I would look at that, and I would say, hey, you know, all the stuff that Jesus is saying is nice and stuff, but going forward, you know, you want to look at the Book of Revelations. And so I believe that the state should be modeled off of the will of God, and that we should really study the Bible and model the state off of the will of God. And so that was my first ever political view. And so I went from that to a Marxist-Leninist. And then from that, I went over into kind of a Francis Fukuyama end of history. I was a big fan of pushing the integrated core down into the gap. I was a neoconservative. I became a fan of the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan after they had lost their popularity. So I've never been a big fan of, I guess, what you call pop politics or democratic politics or anything like that. The closest thing I ever became to a fan of democracy was a neoconservative, and that was a lot more principled than anything that I believe exists today. And then from that, obviously, became a racial separatist, called myself a white nationalist, and then just dropped that eventually and just started to become an opponent of the state. And yep, that's me.
Well, so you actually began as an evangelical Christian then, is that correct?
More than that. I believe that the proper role of the state should be inferred from Scripture.
Okay, so you were something similar to what's commonly called Christian Reconstructionism then. That's interesting, actually. I mean, I find that personally interesting because I came from a similar background. You know, when I was a kid, for a while, my family belonged to a church that was a Christian Reconstructionist church, which believes that the laws of the state need to be modeled on the Old Testament and things like that. And I also grew up in the Christian Zionist subculture, which is, you know, what you see depicted in the Left Behind novels and things like that. Was that similar to your early experience?
I had no idea that I just learned what Reconstructionism is right now. So, I was at odds with my church.
I see. I remember,
yeah. So I didn't really have much of a network, so to speak. I really didn't like how they seemed to kind of pick and choose what verses to follow. I eventually became disillusioned with it when they allowed homosexuals into the priesthood. So it was some sect out in the middle of Kansas.
So how did you go from being a religious theocrat to being a Marxist-Leninist? That's a rather dramatic change.
That is a rather dramatic change. And it wasn't, well, basically accidental, I would say. It was more of I just slowly kind of grew out of believing in God, and that's not, I mean, I'm not a militant atheist or anything. I just kind of stopped believing in it over a period of time. And I just read some articles. I started reading some, I was not a very good Marxist-Leninist at all. I was just kind of, this kind of took to the labor theory of value. It was almost kind of a fashion statement, quite frankly. And, yeah. not much.
Well, that's not uncommon for a lot of younger people. A lot of younger people will adopt some sort of trapping like that. I know, you know, when I was younger, I became involved with the radical left as well. I was never a Marxist-Leninist, but I was a left-wing anarchist, and you know, I could probably, you know, quote, I could probably quote Noam Chomsky books verbatim, you know, like maybe an evangelical really? Christian might be able to quote the Bible or something. You know, I was really hardcore into the left-wing subculture. And you say from there, from Marxism-Leninism, you went where? To neoconservatism?
Yeah. It was kind of a vague... Well, my thinking kind of went like this. In the Muslim world, they have a lot of values that I don't like. I dropped... When I was a neoconservative, I didn't really have much of an economic ideology at all. I was kind of like... Hitler, as you would say, he didn't really have much of a viewpoint on in terms of economic matters. I didn't really view taxes or economic policies as being very important. What I viewed as being important was freedom of speech, democracy. I was a big fan of democracy and voting and representation, and women's rights was important because in the Muslim world, obviously there's certain social mores against the rights of women and the rights of homosexuals. And so I supported U.S. troops going into these countries and forcing them to live by these better values. And this would be, and I viewed this process as ultimately inevitable. And this is something interesting and something that I see in a lot of ideologies. In Christianity, of course, with the rapture, eventually, you know, every tongue will sing his praises, every knee will bow, however they said it. Marx predicted the inevitability of the victory of communism. And if you look at Francis Fukuyama in his book, The End of History, he predicts ultimately this kind of social democratic liberalism, whatever you want to call it, what exists today is eventually going to take over the world and it's going to basically be the end of history. So
how you went from being a Marxist-Leninist to being a neoconservative.
Oh, Victor Davis Hanson. I read a lot of stuff by him. I started reading National Review, that outlet that is kind of not held in very high esteem now, but yeah, basically it.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting how the neocon idea of the liberal democracy, as it's currently practiced in the Western social democracies, as being the end of human social and political evolution is interesting in the sense that it is comparable in some ways to the, you know, the Christian idea of the kingdom to come. That's the final end of humanity, or the Marxist idea of the workers' paradise. Although I think it's not as interesting. I think the Marxists and the Christians, for whatever else could be said about them, have more interesting ideas, even if they're wrong. But that is interesting. Now,
well, they're interesting. They're interesting to you and me because they're kind of alien, I think. Anyway.
Well, and then you went from being a neoconservative to being a white nationalist. Now, that's also a pretty big leap because in a lot of white nationalist circles, neoconservative is a swear word, and vice versa. Yeah. So what prompted that?
What prompted that was. Well, first I started looking at, this is going to sound really bad, right? first I read the book The Bell Curve and learned about race differences and came to my views on race differences. And I don't think you want to go into that. But I came to those views and that didn't lead to white nationalism at all in any way. But then I started reading up on Jared Taylor and started looking at the sort of, I started reading Jared Taylor and looking at, say, South Africa and Zimbabwe and what happened in the end of colonialism, what happens in areas where whites become a minority, and those are not happy things. And it's not fun being a minority anywhere at any time, any place in history. In fact, Mises talked about how bad it was being a minority ethnic group in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Being a minority is no fun. Having the laws that you live under being determined by people alien from you, radically alien from you, is not a fun thing to live through. And so my view on that was saying we as white people, we, the race, need to form our own state separate so that we can have the sort of self-determination away from the laws that we live under and have our lives being directed by others. And as an ancillary effect to that, other racial groups would benefit from that. And of course, you can probably see already how that kind of thinking leads to, well, why just race? You know, why not go further? And then of course the string unraveled and complete total, and race itself actually becomes kind of pointless and starts to seem kind of like a racial state, starts to seem kind of authoritarian when you start looking at all the other possibilities of secession and omniseparatism, as I called it.
So you're saying that you then moved away from a racial determinism towards more of the recognition that there's lots of different kinds of cleavages in human societies.
Yes.
There's class, there's culture, there's ethnicity, there's race, there's religion, there's, moral values, there's, everything really we can conceive of. Now, you've obviously been through a lot of different stops along the way in your own intellectual journey. Over what period of time did this transpire? For example, how many years did it take you from being a Christian theocrat to being where you are now? How long a process was that?
Just the total number of years?
Sure.
From there. Well, I've been what I am now since April of 2008. So this has been the most steady, the most stable. Prior to that, I don't keep track of this. All the interesting stuff happened. I mean, I don't view stuff that happened prior to April 2008 as being particularly interesting. So I don't. It started when I was 12. If you want to know, that's when I started becoming a theocrat.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you started early then. I never really thought much about this stuff until I was in my 20s.
Yeah. It's probably for the best.
Well, I know that the way that I first discovered some of your work was through seeing some of the videos that you had posted online. And I know a few years back in particular, you were involved in a lot of different polemics with a fellow who uses the name Brain Police. Do you want to give us a little bit of the background to that? Because that I think that was something of a fairly big online sword fight there for a while.
Of course you're going to get, if you ask me about that, you're obviously going to get my spin. Just viewer beware. It started out, we were actually, on good terms. In fact, I would actually we'd hang out on Stickam a lot, Brain Police and I, and I'd follow him into rooms and we'd spend hours talking to each other. And we were actually, I considered ourselves as being on good terms. Really, it started out, I wasn't even a racial separatist at this point. I just believed in, race differences in IQ being genetic, which I don't think we want to talk about here, but that's just what I believed. And so I just said that, and I would, tell Brain Police about that. And I believed that, and I thought that people, in a stateless society could separate on the basis of race. I didn't see anything wrong with that. I had kind of stopped, I don't particularly like white people. I don't particularly like white people at all, period. For the most part. So, white nationalism now seems kind of weird given how much of a misanthrope I am. But I was, a fan of that. And I was, say, yeah, people should be able to separate and form little restrictive covenants is what I call them. And that's not good because apparently those things were used in the Jim Crow South to keep blacks out of their neighborhoods. So that's probably a poor choice of words. But basically, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about little housing developments where people come in, they agree only to sell to other Mormons or whatever. And I was a fan of that. And that's really where that disagreement started. And people can look this up, thick libertarianism was what he was talking about, a more robust conception of freedom. That is, to be a libertarian, one must not only support it in the thin sense of, you know, autonomy of people and groups and making their own associations, but to support freedom, a more freedom of action for an individual. Any restrictive covenant impedes a freedom of action for the individual. Like, for example, the individual can't live in an area that is claimed by a group of white nationalists, for example. And then from there, it kind of spiraled off into a debate about objective and subjective morality, but that's not interesting.
Well, I remember following that debate a little bit when it was going on, because I, at the same time, was having a similar debate with a group of people that call themselves the Left Libertarians. And I actually wrote a critique of this thick libertarian concept. I published it on Attack the System about 4 years ago. It's titled, Should Libertarianism Be Cultural Leftism Minus the State? And what I was attacking was the idea of thick libertarianism that some of these people were trying to promote, like Green Police, like some of the folks at what is now the Center for the Stateless Society, the Molinari Institute, and some of those organizations, because it seemed to me that what they were really trying to do was just take all the standard left-wing pet causes and favorite issues and special interest groups and so forth, and the whole PC politically correct paradigm. They were trying to take all of that stuff and sneak it back in through the back door under the banner of libertarianism. And I called them out on that, that and some other things, led to a big explosion between myself and the left libertarians not long after that. And for that reason, I am no longer associated with that particular milieu. I had a similar experience. And this fellow who uses the name Brain Police, I've had some online dueling with him myself as well. Over some of the same kinds of issues, for example, the role of genetics in determining the characteristics of population groups and so forth. Ryan, you made a video a while back with the title "Be an Omni-Separatist." That's a term that's not exactly standard fare in political terminology. So, explain to us, what is an omni-separatist?
An omni-separatist, well, just the two words, omni, meaning, does it mean everywhere or does it mean multi? Because omnipresent means all present. So yeah, basically you're a big fan of separatism of any and all types, and recognize it in the long run. It's best for you, it's best for them, it's best for everyone if they just go where they want to go. And so to be an omni-separatist is to just be a normal human being in the way people behave in their normal day-to-day lives. If someone doesn't want to go to your party, if someone doesn't want to live around you, if someone doesn't want to talk to you as an individual, you don't say, no, you must join our club. You must, live by our house's rules or something like that. No, that's stupid and insane. It only leads to conflict. But when that same exact kind of behavior is enacted at a kind of higher level, more impersonal, indirect way through the acts of state, it's seen as totally rational. And I think a disconnect, a failure to abstract that people have. So when you're an omni-separatist, you're for separatism of just about anyone at all levels, and recognize that that's going to be the most beneficial in the long run.
And according to the criteria for omni-separatism, there can be separatism not only along race lines, but also religion and culture and philosophy.
Economic theory, yeah.
Economic ideology, preferred form of government, all these other things. All right. So it's not any form of determinism then. It's not like, say, Marxism, where it's all about class determinism, or it's not specifically racial nationalism or racial separatism. It's just sort of a separatism of whatever kind you want. Okay. On a practical level then, how would you go about applying this concept of omni-separatism to a real-world society, like, say, the United States in its present form?
What do I have? Like, what am I? Am I like the president, or am I?
Well, I suppose you could really approach it from any angle. I mean, yeah, you could approach it from the angle, okay, let's say the omni-separatist party gets one of its own elected president, or, you know, it could be from the other angle. There could be a grassroots, you know, omni-separatist movement like the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street or something like that.
Well, the first thing, the first thing you're going to have to do is there's a lot of entrenched, because when you have omni-separatist movement, what's going to happen is that a lot of the, you're going to have a lot of religious groups separating, but groups of people don't have equal economic production. And so some groups of people are going to be, are right now, they're net taxpayers, and some people are net tax takers. And when you have people separating, they're separating, saying, "I want to opt out of things like social Medicare, Medicaid, paying all these union stuff for firefighters, teachers, various public workers." You're going to have riots, and you're going to have to deal with those riots. So the first step is there's no real good way to, I thought about doing it, because what you're talking about, like, is kind of a managed transition to market anarchy almost. So what I would start out with is you'd have to have the legal system in place right away. Because if you have a bunch of people going out into an empty area, as existed in the territories in the Western US, people going out there knew what they were getting into. And so they would go out to, and they would set up prairie law beforehand, or they would set up the claims associations beforehand, or they would set up the mining law beforehand. So they know they're going out into the wilderness. The jurisdiction of the US federal government does not apply to this area, so they have to make plans going out there. And so they could build up kind of this emergent legal structure while they were out there. That's not an option that we have right now. So as for a practical transition, if I were president of the United States for this kind of thing, that's not something that I could give you an answer right now, basically.
Well, the reason I'm exploring this issue is because, you know, in the kind of political work that I do, I deal with radical groups of all different types, and including a lot of people who have some sort of revolutionary ideology or some sort of separatist ideology, and that can include anarchists and radical libertarians, and I've discussed this with white nationalists and proponents of ethno states, and also black nationalists and other minority separatists. And I'm always, you know, I'm always interested in the nuts and bolts of these kinds of ideas.
Oh, you want something right now?
Sure.
Okay. What you need to do is you need to, right now, the US is divided up into 50 states. The legality of the sovereignty of the states, I know, is a kind of a disputed subject, but I don't see any better program than finding a state with a low population, moving a bunch of people of your political persuasion, going there, becoming a majority, and then voting for secession, and then hoping that the US federal government doesn't bomb and invade and stop the secession.
Well, there are currently a lot of projects like that underway. There's the Free State Project, the libertarian group that's trying to colonize New Hampshire, and then you have the Christian Exodus group, which is an evangelical Christian group that was at one point had its sights on, I believe, South Carolina. You've got the Northwest Front and other white nationalist groups that have their eyes on Idaho and Montana and that region. And then you've got, of course, Cascadia, which tends to come at things from a more of a bioregionalist outlook in the Northwest as well.
I'm thinking
Have you?
Alaska.
There's Alaska. There's also the Texas secessionist movement. There's, of course, the groups in the South, the
Too
League of
many, yeah, too many people in South Carolina, too many people in Texas. The Free State Project, I believe, has a better idea, because New Hampshire doesn't have as many people, but it has a lot more people than Alaska. Alaska has about 700,000 people. The Northwest Separatist group, that's not gonna. Well, first off, if they're not gonna get Oregon or Washington, too many people there. They the most they could think about getting would be Idaho, but that would be a stretch. Most likely Montana. That's landlocked. They're fucked. So what's good about Alaska is that it has a low population. It's separate from the U.S. It's big in terms of natural resources, so there's lots of room to grow. And yeah, so that's, I mean, Alaska's the, it's already kind of separate right now, so that's why I'm a fan of Alaska. Also, the Alaska Independence Party, I believe got 8% of the vote in Alaska in this last election.
Well, I know that they, I don't know what the numbers are, but they have performed comparatively well for a minor party organization in the United States. And in Texas, actually, a few years ago, there was a fellow who ran for the Senate in the Republican Party primary on a secessionist platform. He wanted to turn Texas into an independent national entity as it was prior to 1836. And he actually received 220,000 votes in that primary, which is a fairly, you know, 250,000 votes is a substantial number. So there is sympathy for these kinds of ideas out there. But I know when I was watching your video on omni-separatism, one thing that I was impressed by was the lack of an emphasis on universalism. You're basically making the argument, well, you know, separatism or omni-separatism is something that people of really any ideological perspective could adopt as a tactic or as a sort of a means towards achieving their ends. Not just people of any one philosophy, and in fact, even people of polar opposite views could practice yes. the same thing. You know, which is in some ways different from what you see in some secessionist movements. For example, you know, I was reading an interview a while back with a guy who was talking about how he wanted California to secede, but then he was saying he was only for secessionist movements from the left. You know, the very idea of a secessionist movement from, say, the right or the far right was, you know, unacceptable. So all secessionists have to be leftists, which seems to me to be self-defeating. I mean, one of the whole point behind separatism is people who can't get along go their own way. So
it sounds to me that guy's not really a separatist. He has a radical agenda that he wants pushed in whatever way possible. That's what it sounds like to me.
And he just sees a secessionism as the potential tactic to use towards that end, and he has no interest in promoting the concept of secessionism per se. Yeah, sure. Have you ever actually become active in any of these kinds of movements or these kinds of projects, or is this
simply, no?
This is simply something you theorize about.
This is all masturbation. Yeah. Sorry.
What kind of response have you gotten to that video? Be an omni-separatist, because it is an intriguing concept.
That video.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Let me see. I mean, I don't, not much. I've had more videos that get more response than this one. I mean, I the response has been, I mean, I think it's been more positive. I haven't, you know, you get the thumbs down that you normally get, but I think it's been more positive than you get on another video, largely because it's not quite as, I don't think it was quite as, sectarian. It wasn't me talking about things that I believe and that I want and that I want to be enforced in my ideal society. It was more just, yeah, I think we've already talked about it here. So,
well, another video of yours that I saw recently was dealt with the theme of those who are truly oppressed seek separation, and one point that you made in that I thought was interesting is that one of the criteria that can be used to distinguish between people who are genuinely oppressed and people who are simply claiming oppression as a means of legitimizing what sort of in whatever sort of political agenda they have, is that if someone is truly oppressed, they want to be separate. For example, you gave the examples of slaves in the old plantation systems. They didn't want to have affirmative action on the plantation. They wanted to leave the plantation. Or people in the totalitarian Stalinist states of Eastern Europe, they would often risk their lives to leave some of those countries. They weren't trying to get into those countries. Sure. How did you go about formulating your thinking on this question?
One thing you can look at is, like, in the United States, you have people who are wanting separation, and you have the demonization of all the separatists. My thinking was pretty much the way you just said it. Like, I don't see a whole lot of when you look at separatist movements in the United States, what you see is a lot of white people. You see a little bit of Aztlan stuff, but I don't think that that's quite as big as neo-Confederates or individual state separatist movements, which tend to be dominated by white males. And I look at that, and when you look at groups, for example, the revolutions in Hungary or the revolutions in Czechoslovakia, they had their, they had the Prague Spring, they had the Hungarian uprisings against Soviet occupation. They did not seek any sort of representation in the Soviet Union. They did not seek any reparations for the wars or anything. They just sought trying to get out. You know, we don't want reparations. We don't want representation. We want out. If you're oppressed, then you're not in any kind of position to demand reparations or representation, right? I mean, if you're in a position to start demanding for those things, you're not oppressed. So that's really all it is. And so if someone is doing that, that's a sign that they're not oppressed. If someone's attacking you, you're not trying to talk him down or anything. You're trying to escape. You're trying to get out of there.
Well, I remember a few years ago, more than a few years ago, I came across an essay by Dr. Thomas Szasz. He was a maverick psychiatrist who was very critical of the psychotherapy profession and the psychiatric industry. He actually passed away a few months ago. I think he was 92 or something like that. But he was talking about this concept of rights talk, what he called rights talk, that we have in the mainstream political discourse in our own society today. And there have been other commentators. I know some from the communitarian milieu. Eddie Onzi or something like that has discussed this. And that is, when you look into a lot of our mainstream political discourse today, we hear a lot of people talking about my rights are being violated or our rights are being violated. And, both sides of the political spectrum within the mainstream society do this, the left and the right. If the religious right will say, well, their rights are being violated because they can't broadcast a prayer over a loudspeaker in public school every morning, or on the left, there's a long list of, long line of victimological groups saying we're oppressed for this reason and that reason. And in virtually all of their cases, all of these different groups, what they really want is more intervention into society by the state on their behalf to give them more privileges, more money, more legal recognition in the name of supposedly rectifying how oppressed they actually are. What I thought was interesting about your argument was that you were saying, well, if they're in a position to do this in the first place, if all the different people claiming to be oppressed from all the different political interest groups that we have in our society today are really that oppressed, then, how is it that they're able to go out and lobby the government to get all of these legislation passed in their favor and get all of these subsidies and get all this legal protection and You know, and of course the demands keep getting ever more extreme. For instance, take the gay rights movement. When that movement first began, it was really just about, well, you know, sodomy laws that are, you know, an intrusion into private conduct should be repealed. You know, gays should be able to have gay clubs without being harassed by the cops. Nowadays, that's taken for granted. That's a settled issue now. Nowadays, it's more about, well, we need to have same-sex marriage that's legally recognized, and we need to have hate crimes protections extended to gays, and we need to have anti-discrimination laws extended not only to gays but also transsexuals and transvestites and all sorts of other, you know, but that kind of, you know, it's always a matter of pushing the envelope, and it's the same thing with all sorts of other political interest groups. It's always once we've achieved what we said our goals were, well, we need more, and we need more, and we need more. But what you would say, it sounds like, is that, well, if all of these different groups like this are so oppressed, you know, how are they able to lobby the state in this particular way in the first place? Is that correct?
That's correct. And another thing I find interesting is to ask yourself a question is, if looking in the matter of, like, racial oppression, one thing you could look at is, how many are white people, are like white kids trying to act black, you know, the Uyghurs, or are black people trying to act white, which is more common, you know? Another question you could ask is how many guys are trying to become girls versus how many girls are trying to become like men? This is not a scientific thing, but I hear lots of stories in the past about, you know, the girls and who wants to do math, and the girl who's interested in science and doing, you know, wants to be one of the guys and all that stuff. Girls pretending to be guys, dressing up like guys so she can get into some university or military thing that she wants to do. That doesn't seem to be quite as common a thing anymore. It seems more going the other way. Guys trying to become girls, guys more wanting to become like girls. I've also noticed a increase in the I guess you would call it chosen minority status, where basically if you're a white male, you're not a minority in any way. So I have a suspicion that there's a lot of guys pretending to be gay when they're not, just so that they can be a minority, right, and have the privileged status that that entails. People saying they have gender identities, they want to be some sort of minority group so they can have, you know, non-white male privilege is what I think is happening there. And you asked the question, where did this train of thought come from? That's where it came from. And I've just started to re-pick it up. That's where it came from. And another thing that Jared Taylor was at this university, I think it was Towson, where they had the white students union, and at the white students, they had the black students union, and he was absolutely getting shouted down, called all sorts of names. It was a zoo, and so that kind of tells me, okay, so you can have a black students union, that's fine. You have a white students union, that's evil, that's horrible, that's oppressive. But then again, the type of people who are trying to separate from the U.S. are the type of people who can't start a students union. American Renaissance can't have a little meetup because they get shouted down. The hotels they try to book get death threats. I believe the mayor of the city, who's a black mayor, did something, said that they couldn't have their meetup in somewhere in Virginia or something. That was
in Charlotte, North Carolina. A couple years ago. Yeah.
So that's just what I have to say. And unfortunately, when you talk about separatism in the United States today, whenever you talk about a separatist movement, you're inevitably it's an inevitable thing that you're going to end up defending primarily the most hated groups, because the most hated groups are the least powerful groups. They're the groups that are most going to want to secede. If we were talking about omniseparatism in 1000 AD, we'd be talking about the atheists and the heretics.
You said that when you start defending the idea of separatism or the idea of secession or decentralization of politics in any particular way, you end up defending groups that really nobody likes very much, or at least are not considered socially acceptable. That struck a chord with me because I know in all the years now that I've advocated for concepts like secession and alternative political philosophies, you know, anarchism and national anarchism and so forth. One criticism that I have gotten, including criticism by many of my fellow anarchists, is, well, you know, I can't, to use a cliched expression, you know, I wish I had a dollar for every time one of my fellow anarchists has told me, you know, Keith, you've got some interesting ideas, but, you know, you associate with all of these really taboo people. You know, you associate with all of these alternative right people, all of these white nationalist people, all of these people who are interested in eugenics, you know, all these, far right militia people and all these, you know, things. And not only that, but you associate with a lot of people with, you know, similarly taboo views and other milieus as well. And they'll, you know, no one's going to, people say no one's going to listen as long as you're associated with those kinds of groups. And I always say, well, but then what would be the point? You know, if I was advocating for, say, secession or the right to have separatist communities or something like that for Democrats and Republicans, you know, what would be the value in that? There wouldn't be, because you're dealing with groups that are satisfied with the system in a particular in their own particular way. When you're dealing with groups that aren't controversial, mm-hmm. So you know, it's kind of like the I remember seeing an article once by a civil liberties attorney, and he was saying that if you're going to be a civil liberties attorney, prepare to defend beliefs and values in a legal context that no one else is going to agree with. You know, it's not difficult to defend the civil liberties of people who say things that everybody wants to hear. But when you start talking about things that when you defend people who say things no one wants to hear, that's where the trouble comes in. And the race issue, I think, is as controversial as anything nowadays. You know, it's one thing that I think is just really fascinating about the left is that to hear the left tell their story. You know, whenever I discuss social issues, for example, with leftists, to hear them tell the story, you would think that African Americans were still slaves being held on the plantation. You would think that.
Yeah.
You would think that gay people were regularly being stoned to death on Main Street, or that women were being kept up, you know, kept tied to a post in their husband's rooms or something. You know, it's when I hear that kind of rhetoric, I always think, well, what society do these people live in? Do they watch television? Do they go out in public and see how the world really is? Why, in your judgment, because I know you've dealt with these issues, why, in your judgment, do you think the left holds this kind of delusional worldview?
It's more about power and this kind of, and, you know, it was funny. There was this radio show that I listened to a while ago with a bunch of black, I forget what their political views were, but I remember they called Tim Wise, and we all know, I think people listening to the show know who Tim Wise is. They called Tim Wise a white supremacist. And I was listening to that. I was like, what the fuck are they talking about? Well, Tim Wise is a white supremacist in that he has this delusional view of the supremacy of white people controlling everything, right? That white people are all powerful, have the ability to solve all these problems if only they would, you know, solve all these quote-unquote problems, the problems being inequality of outcome, if only white people would do what needed to be done. And I think that it's this view, what I would call descriptive white supremacy, that I believe Tim Wise holds to, and I believe that these people hold to, not quite as explicitly as Tim Wise does, but kind of implicitly, all of their arguments are kind of settled on that. And so when they say that, like, black people are being oppressed, there's two implicit assumptions here that they're working on. One is this a tacit white supremacy, and the other is this tacit view of innate equality in the brain and all groups of people. Not individuals. Individuals can have innate differences, but all groups. And because of that, any outcome inequality can't be a result of anything biological. I mean, that's racism, pseudoscience, old colonial 1800s, neo-Darwinian eugenicists, blah, 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 blah. So it can't be that. And they also have kind of this, I would say, almost a kind of an oddly deterministic view of things. Like if a group doesn't have, like a group's economic outcomes is going to be almost like determined by circumstance. It's really weird. Like you take these people, give them a circumstance, the outcome is predetermined almost. And if you had a powerful enough computer, you could like predetermine every outcome for every social group. And that's why I think you have a degree in sociology, I don't. But I almost have the suspicion that sociologists think that if they could just have a powerful enough computer, they could predict any outcome for any group of humans, Homo sapiens, if they know all the correct inputs. And so when they view any outcome inequality between groups of people, that has to be down to environment. And who controls the environment? Well, the group that is supreme, white people. So that's what I think that is.
Well, I think that one way of looking at this is with the concept of constrained and unconstrained visions. I know Thomas Sowell, who is an African American sociologist, he's something of a neocon in many of his political leanings. So, and I frequently disagree with him on certain questions. But one thing that he argues is that a problem with the left is that it has this unconstrained vision of humanity. They have this idea that, well, if there's anything wrong with society or with people or groups of people, well, it's somebody's fault. Somebody made them that way. Somebody did something to them. Or it's simply because we just don't have the will to go out and make everything right. And we just have to get this will to achieve the kind of society they think we ought to have. And we'll get there. And of course, if we take a realistic view of human nature, we see that that's nonsense. And we see that, not only are there differences between individuals, some people are more intelligent than other people. Some people are more motivated than other people. Some people have better character than other people. Some people simply are born into better circumstances with other people. Some people have better luck. Some people are environments where there's a better geographical or environmental circumstance that contributes to their own growth and development. That's true of individuals. That's true of groups as well. And for that reason, we're always going to have inequality. There's always going to be inequality of individuals, of families, of ethnic groups, of cultural groups, of geographical regions, of cultures, of nationalities.
Can I interject? I'd say the inequality of groups based on geography, that's obviously something that I would that I think people of quote unquote the left, I'll just use that term, of the left, are fine with, because that's an environmental thing, right? That's not anything intrinsic to groups. And so basically the And in fact, Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel says it's all about that. He's basically an ecological determinist. So, okay.
Continue. At the same time, though, I do think that many people on the left consider inequality of geographical regions to be unacceptable. It's to them, it's an awful thing. It's an awful thing in their mind, for instance, if some countries are poorer than others, or if the standard of living in one country is lower than the other, or in one state, or in one city, or one neighborhood. They have this radically egalitarian idea that says that everyone, every place, every time ultimately must be equal in terms of equality of condition, equality of outcome. As well as, the equality not only of legal rights, but of social status and, civil prestige and all these other kinds of things. What is your vision of the good society? I mean, let's assume this omni-separatism concept were to take off, and the Alaskan Independence Party is doing their thing, and the Northwest Front, and the Second Vermont Republic, and the Nation of Islam, the Lakota Republic, they're all doing their own thing. And Ryan Falkland, what's going to be going on there?
I actually haven't given it that much thought. I haven't given Ryan Falkland that much thought.
Well, what do you think might be some general organizing principles then for your own ideal political community?
I'm a big fan of usufruct, active use property norms. Ideally, you don't want to have any. There, are, I've talked about how to fund legal services, how to fund defense. I don't know what really to go into here. I mean, I just.
Well, you mentioned usufructory property norms. Are you familiar with the work of Kevin Carson? And if so, what is your assessment of some of his ideas?
No, I'm not familiar with his views on active use property norms.
Okay. Well, usufructory property rights, of course, is the idea that ownership should be based on use and possession. Mm-hmm. That may be a concept that some of my listeners are not familiar with. Yeah. We're more used to, as Americans, we're more used to the Lockean concept of property ownership rights, which means that you just, you take what you can get. It's just unlimited accumulation. Actually, the usufructory concept of property rights is something that I believe is part of the social teachings of the Catholic Church, and it's derivative to some degree of the distributist philosophy that some of the romantic medievalists like mm-hmm. Chesterton and Belloc came up with. One thing that's interesting, because you mentioned that you don't really know what your own ideal community would be on a personal level, and I've been asked that myself. I've been asked questions like, we promote these ideas like pan-secessionism and neighborhood anarchism and radical decentralization, and what would be the ideal Keith Preston land? And I don't have clear views on that either. For one reason, I don't plan on being here when all this stuff is finally realized, if it ever is, or else I'll be a very, very old man and, probably not very in tune with things. I promote these ideas because of where I see our civilization itself going, our civilization in North America and in the Western world. I think that, our civilization has seen its better days in many ways and is deteriorating. I think that in the United States, we're going to see the United States over time start to go in the same direction as the Soviet Union. It's going to be a once great empire that just sort of unravels. And for the same kind of reasons, military overstretch, political loss of political legitimacy and an increased reliance on repression to keep order, cultural and ethnic and strife, economic bankruptcy, all the things that did in mm-hmm. the Soviet Union are happening in the West.
Right. Yes. And one thing I think that's very funny in regards to the United States and the Soviet Union is how in the Soviet Union you'd have the powers that be would blame the problems not on the basic ideas themselves, not on whatever the hell the Soviet Union was. I mean, it certainly wasn't Marxist at that point. They wouldn't blame it on that which is in power, that which is enforced. They would blame it on people. They would blame it on the black and the gray market. They would blame capitalist. They blame it on something, anything other than what is in power and what is in place. And I see the exact I see a similar thing going on in the United States, where people are looking at why is the U.S. in such a relatively bad situation. In terms of living standards, it's actually not quite as bad, but I believe in terms of structural health, in terms of proportion of the population that is unemployed, and the debt to GDP ratio and the personal debt levels, I think the U.S. in those is structurally weaker than it has been at any point in history, or at least pretty close to it. Anyway, and instead of blaming Republicanism, democracy, instead of and saying, look, the Constitution was put in place, the Constitution has been enforced, here's the results, that's why things are bad. The United States was doing well to the extent that the U.S. federal government did not have its way, was not doing anything. Instead of looking at it from that point of view, they can't say that what exists and what is enforced and what is beloved and cherished is what's causing all the problems. They can't say that, so they have to make up the New World Order and Illuminati and all these what I call intricate conspiracy theories. I'm a fan of like simple, shallow conspiracy theories. I mean, people conspire all the time, but like these real, I think that's where New World Order comes from. It creates a boogeyman to blame the problems on without having to look in the mirror.
Well, I think you're right, particularly in the sense of when you touch on mass democracy as really being part of the downfall of the United States. You know, if we look at the history of the United States, the more we've become a mass democracy under a centralized state, the more problems we've had in many ways. And particularly as we become more diverse culturally, you know, I think it was Hans Hermann Hoppe who said that mass democracy combined with multiculturalism combined with the welfare state is really just a war of each of all against all. It's really just a low grade civil war.
Right.
And Cold ultimately, war. Yeah, it's a system. The kind of system we have now is something that pretends to be everything for everybody and ends up being nothing for no one. I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to have you back on the program to discuss these issues at some point in the future. I do thank you for joining us this evening. We've been talking with Ryan Falk.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And this is Keith Preston for Attack the System. We'll see you next week.